Hello and welcome to the Alive, Digital Humans and Their Organizations podcast. This series explores themes and topics relating to all things digital and the shift we're experiencing as the digital era impacts our lives everywhere. My name is George Seiler, I'm from the Ludic Group, and this episode is brought to you by the authors of the book, Alive, Digital Humans and Their Organizations, published by Navarro and available on Amazon, Kindle, and in bookstores near you. This episode is about learning in our digital era. We're joined today by the authors, Paul Ashcroft.
Hello.
And Garrick Jones.
Hi.
With our special guest, David Perring.
Hello, thank you.
So, David, you describe yourself as a serial educationalist, and you've been working in the field of people development for over 25 years with a focus on innovation and learning. You work as an independent analyst at the Fosway Group, who specialize in HR, talent, and learning. Great to have you with us. Tell us a bit about yourself.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure and honor to be here today. I suppose as an analyst working in the HR space, we're in a very privileged position to sit on the fence and look at what providers and organizations are doing around organizational learning in HR and try and raise everybody's bar by really trying to create more transparency between what's really successful rather than some of the bullshit that floats about.
Right. So this is from the chapter Always Learning. And I'm going to read it as a provocation, David, because we're very interested in what you have to say. But we wrote, humans have always had a desire for learning, and it is through the gathering of knowledge and education that our species has progressed from agricultural society through industrial society to the knowledge economy and now the digital epoch. Each has required its own sets of life skills and knowledge. Shifts in political economy from feudalism to industrialization, and with it democracy, required different knowledge bases for people to perform the different roles they require in civil society. What do you think?
That's a very big quote. That's my initial reaction. But I think it's true. I think we look at organizations today, especially in the corporate space, and there are so many significant changes that seem to be happening, both digital and demographic. So the arrival of millennials and Gen XYZ, W, whatever's coming after that, Gen K, I think, is supposed to be arriving soon. And that's creating some really significant changes in how people work and their expectations about work. And I think on top of that, what we've sort of come back in terms of our research, we found that there is a growing expectation that organizations are moving faster, and there is a growing expectation that people need to learn faster to keep up. So there is a real speed imperative that's pervading organizations because of the way digital's taking hold in organizations. And there's a guy called Peter Sondergaard, who's an analyst, who talks about every organization now being a software organization. Mm. And if you think that starts to bring with it things like agile methodologies, in the past people used to take a year to come up with a product. Mm. Now they're taking maybe 2 or 3 months, maybe a month. And that drives a really rapid cycle of trying to adapt and change, and without understanding how you can help people learn at pace, then I think organizations are going to start to fall by the wayside. So it's a real big imperative to both have a learning organization that can move fast, but also hire people who have a predisposition to learn, because actually those are the people who help you survive as an organization.
I'm fascinated by how you talk about how people can learn in organizations. I'm interested in what may have changed. What's changed between how people used to learn in organizations, what digital is allowing us to do.
I think it was something like Tennessee Williams said, the biggest distance between two points is time. And I think that's one of the things that the digital side of things really gives us, is that ability to reach across distance. And I think that drives speed. So it was a time when we talked about face-to-face being actually like we are now, together. But with the advent of things like FaceTime, WhatsApp video, we can be face-to-face and thousands and thousands, if not millions of miles apart, whether you're in the space station, on the ground. And that is a massive transformation moment, let alone all the things that you can capture and record and play back. And I think that's a real shift in people's expectations about being able to connect and acquire and interact in ways that actually it would have taken me weeks to get to Cairo, for example. But you can be in Cairo now if you wanted to, just by switching on video conference. And that immediacy of interaction, I think, really is part of the game changer. But also that it sort of creates some other things about just the consumption of content. It's immediate in a way that I don't think it's ever been so before in the ever before.
For many years, when the words digital and learning are ever put together in the same sentence, people immediately think e-learning.
Yeah, exactly.
Are people still thinking e-learning? Is e-learning dead?
Personally, I think I wish it was a bit more dead than it is.
Why is that?
Because I think what's interesting to me is that what we used e-learning to do probably over the last 15 years is to isolate people. We've taken people down technology route where e-learning means here's a piece of content, go into a corner and sit on your own. And we know that that is quite useful, potentially from an academic point of view, to try and cram knowledge into your brain short term, but it doesn't necessarily really develop any meaningful learning, because meaningful learning happens when you try to apply and sustain your learning in an organization, in a context. And that has been the thing that has been missing probably from 99% of what we'd call traditional e-learning in organizations. And actually the richest learning comes when we interact together.
Yeah. Sure.
And the critical thing is when we get feedback from each other, and without prompting that into the learning design and think about how we become more social learners in a way, then I think we've sold the learning technology story really short, because it's been about massification rather than development.
And I really agree with you about some of those old forms of learning being very low down on the evolutionary scale. Yeah. We know, you know, to build on what you're saying, that the best learning and best meaning and reinforcement, not only from being together and communicating together in groups and peers and people you respect, people you can learn from, but also making things together.
Yes.
So this idea of constructing new realities, design thinking comes up again, where you're kind of prototyping and wireframing and testing and learning and learning as you go, but making things together. And the combination of those, that kind of communication together, making things together, and the digital opportunities, I think, changes the game in terms of, there's, you know, you can get people making videos, actually prototyping 3D cam with a team in London and a team in Delhi and a team in Los Angeles, all working on the same digital files, making stuff, testing things, building stuff, printing stuff. It's astonishing what can be achieved.
And it's interesting. I was lucky enough to be on the awards for the Learning Technology Awards for Most Innovative Product last week. And there are some amazing things that are happening around social learning in that space. And there's an organization called Halma. And they had 41 different companies spread around the globe. They focus on medical instrumentation and data and all these things. And they've got effectively 41 little silos around the globe that they've managed to create. They've managed to connect through a virtual social platform. And out of those connections, they've started to develop some new products, purely because people are able to connect from people from Singapore to Spain, to the UK, to South America. And now they think they're working through a pilot in Africa where they're going to put in some advanced treatments around people with cataracts. So they start to detect cataracts early because they've been able to connect people at distance. And I think that whole co-creation, that's the world that we're now living in, where people can reach out and learn from people that would have previously been in a regional or isolated silo.
Yeah.
So technology and digital learning is now no longer just e-learning, a one-dimensional form. The good old solution for delivering learning at scale in a cost-effective way.
Yeah.
E-learning is very cost-effective. Yeah. But is it effective?
Yeah.
And I think what I've heard you say, David, is that actually as you get into a much more blended learning, you can achieve the same sorts of results you can do with a face-to-face learning program, but do that digitally.
Yeah.
And for many more people, and solve the speed problem that you talked about.
Yeah, and I think that what organizations have struggled to do from our research is actually been able to execute blended learning well. It takes effort, it takes insight, it takes resources that people haven't necessarily historically had in place. So having people who can act as virtual coaches, for example, they haven't had those. So their blends have always fallen short. And I think there's a great opportunity to think about how we can bring the human into the digital learning in a way that's been ignored quite substantially. And I know the things that you guys do are very much focused on trying to accent that feedback, the continuous connections, because that drives richer learning. And I think it's something that others need to learn from.
I was around for the first sort of massive change in learning, which was when learning spaces and learning environments were shifted and became massive, parallel, flexible learning spaces with lots of feedback, very highly rich, stimulating environments. And that had a huge impact not only on learning experiences, but also on organizations. And the key thing behind that was the design, not only to have a great environment, but also the design of the experience you went through. And as much sophisticated ideas were put into the design of the learning experience, had an impact on what kind of learning experience people had. And now we're starting to see, whereas the four walls of the building did all the heavy lifting, you can't just have people having a web connection or looking at each other on Skype. That's not a learning experience. You have to have a platform online, I believe, that does the heavy lifting online. Yeah. We also have to learn to be online in different ways. Yes. The things that work online are not the same things that work together. Being together in the same space, we can look each other in the eye and we can do stuff together. Online, we've discovered that looking at another person on video is distracting. But how do you find things that you can work on together that mean you're all working from the same idea? So there's some new principles that define this new platform. And it'd be interesting for me to understand a little bit of some of what you think some of those principles might be.
Oh, crikey.
And another big question.
That's a very big question.
Sorry.
I don't know where to start. Paul?
One I would start with is about personalization. So not one size fits all. I think there is the opportunity to really make learning relevant for each individual. Now, of course, you can do that together, right? That's much more easy. You can tailor the learning to the individual needs. When you're doing that for thousands of people who you may not get together, I think the ability to do that through digital tools, I think that's one of the design principles around how to design successful learning.
Yeah. And I think the other thing about what you talked about, Garrick, in terms of having a strong sense of outcome and co-creation, I think that sort of going out and solving real problems, having that sort of action learning orientation, being supported or augmented by the technology is something that's really important. I think if I probably took away any principle around how to create a richer learning experience, I'd say put the individual, like Paul said, at the center in terms of that personalization, but also think about how can I make it less about the consumption of knowledge, but more the creation of outcome. And I think that creates some really interesting points, especially when you start to hook in things like feedback from experts and reflection with coaches to really drive people's reflection about, so I've learned these things, I've tried to apply them, what would make that better?
Is this about learning at the point of application?
I tend to try and think of it as like a learning cycle, which takes us from having some sense of measurement, where are we today? And that can come from multiple sources, whether it's business workflows, sort of the stats around quality circle, sort of quality assessment, or just somebody's self-assessment, manager assessment, 360s. And then sort of trying to prompt people through this cycle of, actually, so what does that mean? What should I do about it? Actually sitting down and trying to absorb and learn something, but then, like you say, slip into that mode of apply my learning, see what really makes a difference, is it making a difference, and then sustaining it over time where you need to, and then getting the feedback again to say, actually, so where am I now? Did it make a difference? Did it not? And that can work on so many different levels, from my personal impact and effectiveness through to hard numbers in sort of what quality rating do I now get on my contact center stats.
You've mentioned, and we've talked about the kind of the future of learning being about bespoke or personalized learning journeys on a very, very large scale. Paul was talking about that. Talking about having connected experts, people who you can connect to very easily and quickly when you need it. We've talked about flexible and curated experiences and multimedia, providing all these things, and community-based stuff, as well as real-time feedback, which is underpinning the shift in learning. The one thing we haven't talked about is gamification.
Yeah, sure.
And what's your views on what's happening there? What do you see going on?
I think the interesting thing around the phrase gamification is I think it's quite a Marmite-type phrase. Mm. I know that's necessarily translated internationally.
You hate it or love it?
But you hate it or love it, right? And I think people create that initial reaction just to the phrase gamification. And if you change the language to engagement, then so what tools would you use to keep people engaged? Mm-hmm. And we know that people, and especially my children, are addicted to games, right? So, and that's leaderboards, it's levels, it's all the, sort of, I suppose, the interactions that you get in that sort of gamification mode, whether they're structural out leaderboards or just the way things flow.
So you're saying people are almost turned off by that label, but actually if you can invoke those principles, then you get a lot more stickiness.
I think it's proven, if that makes sense. I think looking at things like people's use of mobile phones, there are gamification features in our mobile phones, which we get flagged to, which create the sort of anxiety that triggers us to overindulge in them, right? So you see a red alert on an app and you try not to look at it. It doesn't work. You go, right? And these are things that are built into those apps. The scrolling, the continuous scrolling. These are gamification features. Mm. But I think if you change language to engagement features, then suddenly I think that takes down a whole swathe of resistance.
Certainly in business, you see that, you know, many people would be, are we just playing games?
Yeah.
And what's the point in that? And what's the value in that? And certainly we've seen that where organizations really have engaged in game playing, it's made a massive difference to engagement.
Yeah.
And also the way they connect online and digital game playing with physical game playing as well. The two things can link together.
But it's interesting for me, because from my time of sort of being trained as a teacher, I was a teacher before the national curriculum came in. I trained to be a teacher then. And a lot of the principles that we were encouraged to adopt were about trying to create a learning environment which was fun and gamified. And that seems to have been lost a little bit in the pursuit of knowledge. But actually, the importance for our children to become lifelong learners, to be infused by the prospect of learning, is so critical. And I think if you're thinking of the corporate space, it's just as important. But I think that sometimes people get lost in the label.
I want to just pick up, you just mentioned lifelong learning, which is a big topic in learning at the moment. And the idea, I suppose, that what type of skills, what type of knowledge do we need to build up within individuals? What do organisations need to focus on? When the sorts of jobs, perhaps, in 5 or 10 years that people will be doing may be completely different from those that we have today.
Mm.
So how do we solve that? How do we solve this? Keep lifelong learning, but we don't know what to be teaching.
I think there's a strong cultural overtone to that. I think there's a strong leadership layer to that, encouraging people to reflect. I remember in my time, some of the best managers that I had, one of their first questions that they had was, what have you learned today? Right? And I think it's simple behaviours and simple actions like that start to set the undertone of, actually, you are surrounded by learning all the time. And I just want to tease out of you what the most special moment that you've had today has been. And I think that's almost set some of the cultural overtones. But then just, I think, encouraging people to create that community of building expertise and mastery. Dan Pink talks about autonomy, mastery, amongst these three things of driving employee engagement. I think you just have to release people, like you said at the beginning.
It's an
innate thing for people to want to grow.
There's this question of speed as well, and you talked about it earlier. The speed at which an organization can learn has an impact on the bottom line, because especially with strategies changing so fast, not only what they're trying to achieve, but how they achieve it. Those skills have to shift very quickly and be reorganized like a Rubik's Cube almost for organizations to thrive. And do you have a sense of what gives certain organizations or systems the edge in terms of the new learning?
To me, I think it is also, I think it's that cultural touchstone again, because I think you need to have the permission to be able just to go and learn. And I think that's an interesting challenge when actually organizations are incredibly lean. There isn't much time to do other than anything other than the day job, in a way. So I think that there is something in that sort of side of things of how do you both create space and permission to do things that aren't necessarily that immediate business-aligned learning activity, because they're serendipity, right?
Yes, and it reminds me also of that trope, you have to sometimes slow down in order to speed up.
Yeah.
If you do give people in your organization the opportunity to learn things that they want to learn and that they're passionate about, you find they bring that passion back to the game.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's the knock-on consequences of learning a new skill that empowers you or helps you to achieve something in a field that you're enthusiastic about.
Yeah.
That projects into other fields that you operate in.
So in an ideal world, if I'm leading an organization, I'm going to, at scale, personalize learning to everybody. It's tailored to their needs. It's just in time. They can practice it in. But is that a reality? What's getting in the way of that? Do you see, David, when you're looking at organizations?
Yeah, I think, unfortunately, it's far from a reality.
Right.
And I think it's partly because the way that L&D organizations are set up is not to scale to deliver that.
Mm.
And actually, even to focus on that is not something that people tend to do when they look at their learning and development teams. So I think you'd need to almost re-engineer the entire team to think in a different way about how they enable more personal learning, right? So that's the space and the energy and the motivation.
I'm not going to mention the organization, but we came across a team who would not get into Platform for Global Learning because it meant it would stop their facilitators and learning people from earning air miles as they traveled around. So you've got to overcome some of the kind of basic human
drivers
and replace it with more powerful, more meaningful drivers that are going to get them down the line. I'm reminded of a weird story when Laurence Olivier was working with Marilyn Monroe here in London, Elstree. They were making a film called The Prince, which I don't know if you've seen. It's not bad. But the thing about Marilyn was she brought Stokowski with her because she was very much into the method acting, and she spent a lot of her time working on her motivation and trying to be, you know, the real deal, and she was living it. And she was late again for the set. And she came up to Laurence Olivier and said, "Can I ask you some advice, Mr. Olivier, about how I should portray this part of the thing?" And he said, "Act, my dear. Just act." And it makes me think about, you know, sometimes we can over-egg the pudding in terms of all the learning stuff. Because I think the learning stuff is pretty simple.
Yeah.
It's like, get the basics right. People want to learn some stuff. They need resources. Yeah. They need it in a multimedia way. They need to be able to access it when they can, at the time that they need it. And fundamentally, then they need access to resources, other coaches, other faculty, people who can help them support that, and a community of people they can learn with.
Yeah.
And finally, let's get them making things so that when they're working together, they're actually testing and driving and testing reality. Yeah. People aren't learning in some kind of hyper-relational, strange, disconnected reality or bubble. They're actually learning from reality as we move forward, getting the feedback, as you say.
Yeah.
And where should this investment in learning sit, in your view, Garrick? Should it be centrally coordinated by the organization, or should it sit within the business units themselves?
That's a really good question. I think David will have a view, but my view is, let's see if they're the same. But my view is that it should be decentralized. I think, of course, there should be budgets that drive the entire thing. But I think that if you have too much homogeneity in a system, you get rid of diversity, which is what's required for proper, powerful systems to evolve. And by as we get more global, you run that risk of homogenous learning, and you kind of get into problems of fascism and not democracy and problems of oligarchy and so on. But those philosophical things drive my belief that budgets are best held at the more local level.
But harvest the innovation that comes from those different areas.
And
right?
By all means, get people talking to each other and get people cross-pollinating using the online tools.
Yeah. And but I think there's another layer that maybe is a little bit more radical, even further, is to say, actually give it to the individuals.
Oh my God.
Right? And I think
you're saying, advocating everyone should have their own learning budget and they spend it on what they think
like.
They want.
Now, maybe there's some balance, not maybe all the money, but what would be the consequences of saying, here's your pot. Do something useful with it.
We did something similar, but not that radical, where on one of the programs, Paul, we gave everybody tickets. They had a kind of voucher system where you had a budget of vouchers which you could spend on various forms of learning.
Yeah, I mean, whenever you put the power of the decision-making in the person that needs the learning, then most likely they're going to choose something relevant for them, right? Whether it gets spent, as you said, organizations also have time pressure. Yeah. So can people find the time? Yeah. And sometimes it does need to be facilitated, made possible as well. But I would agree. I would support that. I would say if you can put the budget in the hands of the learner, then great. We certainly see this on programs that we're doing where the program only really runs where the individuals themselves are prepared to pay for it, i.e. their part of the organization is prepared to pay for it.
How do you get that balance between what the individual would require, what, you know, everybody's off doing guitar lessons, right? rap lessons, sorry, George.
Whatever floats your boat.
But how do you get that balance between what the individual requires from their own personal development and the corporate or the organizational or the system, network, tribe, whatever you want to call it, that their learning requirements? How do you make that balance?
I don't know, but I think there is something that actually, is everybody going to do guitar lessons? And what implications does that have?
Yeah.
If they are happier and more fulfilled and more energetic and more energized in work, was that worth it? And actually, does that mean that they've got a closer rapport with their team because actually they're more fulfilled? It needs some research. It probably needs some real research to actually understand the implications. But I think it's a radical way of turning the motivation thing on its head. And I think invariably people tend to think about things that are value them. If they've got a lot of stress and challenge at work, I think they'll invest in work.
And
if they've got some aspirations, they'll fulfill those.
Because thinking as a leader or as the owner of a business for a moment, you know, I worry about quite a lot about the kind of jazz hands mentality and too much Pollyanna. Everything's utopian and fabulous, I really think we have to counter some of that thinking. Yeah. But the reality is, as a business owner, if people are working hard and giving their all and their lives for the corporate effort, it's almost a no-brainer that we should be contributing to everybody's lives and their own personal advancement at the same time. Because it's a...
You don't just have your work persona, but you are a total person, right? And then, and I suppose the workplace itself, and with digital, the boundaries are blurring ever more, aren't they, between your work life and your home life, in inverted commas. So that sounds like a great philosophy to be holistic about it.
Yeah, and learning tennis together is not a bad thing. These are not new ideas, actually.
Yeah, exactly.
Sure.
Corporates and so on have had tennis teams and all kinds of stuff for years, so... But how do we take that sentiment online?
But I think on the other side, actually, we can also signpost the things that the organisation is looking for. And those may be about career opportunities, future direction, future projects that also enable people to opt in to the future of the organisation as well. So I think there's ways of balancing
out. Well, it's aligned to something that we've been talking in an earlier podcast about unbossing.
Yeah.
And unbossing the organisation so that teams and individuals can lead themselves. Now, again, perhaps it's a Pollyanna, rosy glass view of the future, but putting the ownership of what's your learning going to be in the hands of the individual. If you're expecting lifelong learning, telling people that this is the course you need to do this year probably is the opposite of that.
The other thing that David has really encouraged us to go further, you know, if you could put the budgets in the hands of the individuals, reminds me of a future scenario that I've heard about Bitcoin and the Bitcoin platform, what's called blockchain, being used to validate people's learning throughout their careers. So you may have gone on any course anywhere. You've had a blockchain validation of every course you've been on, whether it's small, large, guitar lessons, tennis lessons, or how to speak in front of 10,000 people. It's all part of your blockchain learning record, and which allows you to get to a future where perhaps not only is your learning validated, but it's also you have a CEO who achieved that position following the following learning journey, which can be validated and audited through the blockchain technology. Yeah. What do you think of that as a future scenario?
I think it's coming. I think some of it's already here in a way, because you get the whole concept of e-portfolio, and we've already had the sorts of things around badgification of people's, especially technology programs. You look at IBM, they're awash in blockchain certification 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 expert guru levels. So those things, I think, are almost part of the scenery, but I'm not sure if they've necessarily pervaded into the sort of academic world or the broader, space.
It makes me think of the passport or the wallet that arrived on our phones, Androids and Apples and so on, which has become ubiquitous now for all kinds of ticketing and so on. Why not learning?
On all of this topic, it's really making me think a lot about access to learning, because that is such a fundamental topic. And then that really has a role between government, business, and the educational sector to enable that, so that if you are using blockchains to validate someone's potential or where they should be in an organization, how do you ensure access to learning?
That's a big question.
It's a big question.
I'm not sure if it's quite if the world's quite ready. I think it's one of those things that will grow organically, a bit like, I was going to say, LinkedIn. It started from nothing, and suddenly every man and their dog and their pet goldfish is on LinkedIn, and they have a lot of data now. And I think the same thing will probably happen over time. There will be a certain gravity point, the Facebook equivalent or whatever it will be. Maybe we'll start to suck in the data, because you just want to go one place, right?
Yeah, there's certainly not a shortage of content, right? There's not a shortage of rubbish content. And you talk about curated content, David, right? As to how do you know what's good? And if you open up your organization to say, well, actually, just go learn online.
That's right.
And learning is everywhere. Yeah. Is it relevant?
Is it good?
How do you validate?
But we know the good sources, right? So
if you
I think people inherently have a good tuning in for this, right? So if I want to find out about economics, where would I go, right?
As you go to the brands and the universities.
Yeah, exactly.
We've known that.
Exactly.
So branded material, which has been curated by great brands, will probably maintain.
Exactly. So I think you end up seeking out people like LSE, MIT for being your source, and then you just have to try and filter it through. And I think what we're starting to see is that sort of curation engine starting to appear, and you're starting to get automated feeds that focus on a set of publications. So if you're a surgeon, then there's a narrow set that you're interested in, and you start to filter out the other things. And I think the challenge that we've seen is the problems with recency, because it's the recent stuff that tends to get surfaced quite often rather than the classic, if that makes sense, the text, the real thing that says this is the thing that you should read to give you a core understanding.
Right. You you mentioned some of the big name universities there, David. As we move on from perhaps the idea that learning is something you do when you are young and then you just have that in your backpack and get on with your life, rather than I have some learning partners or some sources of learning that I just dip into throughout my life if I'm going to do lifelong learning. What's the role of universities in that and these sorts of big education providers? Are they a brand that you subscribe to as part of your kit bag?
I think that's a really big question.
Another big question.
We're full of big questions.
I have to find a different phrase for that. But, it's a really interesting question, because I'm not sure if the universities have quite tuned themselves into what's required of continuous learning for the 21st century. I think they're still stuck in an ancient model in a way. And I think what they need to think about is how they gear up to both be more affordable for individuals and more scalable and more practically impactful. I think it's hard if you think about sort of the advanced research scientist, right? That's a spec. But for other areas where you start to think about applied research, actually there's an intermediate step. It's almost the sort of post-university.
And it's a learning thing. I mean, universities, famously, there was the ELLIPSE program in this country where they tried to put all this content online. That failed. They couldn't make it work. Who was going to pay for it?
It actually comes to a point you both were talking about, Paul and Garrick, about the content that's been curated. How do you make sure that it's living and that people are actually accessing it?
Well, many learning management systems perhaps fall into this problem. As David's smiling, he knows it's a bugbear of mine, that the learning management systems are perhaps the libraries on the high street of old, which is the place of dusty shelves that nobody goes to anymore. But actually, that's not true. Although many of the libraries, sadly, have closed, they have reinvented themselves as community places for, for learning, and they work hard.
Nowhere stores or knowledge stores.
Well, yeah, but they activate, even your local library actively animates learning communities. And I think that's something that can be learned from when you're running online programs as well. The active animation of the community that's doing the learning to avoid that well-known drop-off of
It comes back to your point about humans being at the center of the digital, because if you don't have humans animating, activating and using, things die.
Yes.
There's no, no surprises there.
But even communities come together, they form, they settle, they slowly disperse, they die as well. But I think it's really interesting, because I think for the universities, they don't have to do a great deal to bring people together and enable those communities to try and sustain themselves.
But many people will have had a great experience. They would be happy to contribute their expertise or their time if only they were given space. An easy to way, easy to...
David, one thing I'm fascinated about is the types and formats of learning content and what learning can do for people, particularly with digital. If we cast forward a few years, so if we are suggesting a world where we are gradually moving beyond just teaching facts and knowledge, but into how to be, how to create, how to invent and so on. What are some of the ways that you're seeing that people are doing this? I mean, I had a conversation this week where one organization is looking at how you tackle childhood obesity. That's not an e-learning program, tackling childhood obesity, sending out a bunch of fact sheets and some information to a family who perhaps can't afford all the great ideas is not just poor education, it's demotivating and going in the opposite direction. I mean, what have you seen that works?
What I think works is actually encouraging people to come together, even at distance. And I think, and also providing a sense of structure and pathway, a sense of journey. I think that really works. But I think one of the things that you have to try and wrestle with a bit is the different contexts for what is useful. So if it's in my day-to-day work, actually at point of need and I'm needing things to recall, then actually it's performance support, which is probably that's the trigger. That's the transformational moment for me. If it's about trying to build future capability, maybe it's about trying to develop learning culture, trying to put some way markers to say, this is the skills that are really important to us or our organization going forward. Co-opt yourself into this game because it's going to be exciting. And then there's just the whole serendipity of personal learning. So actually, just to feel as though I belong and I'm growing myself and making myself more energized, actually that's a whole layer. And I think there's almost different models that sort of tick different boxes depending on
the context.
On the context. And I think that's the most important thing in a way, just to narrow in on the context of what is the breakthrough moment for the human in that, in their story. So if it's at work, what makes the best difference?
It's amazing. It makes me think of, I'm a composer and I've always been behind the ball when it comes to software and composing. And, you know, I'd like to think I know what's going on, but the software comes so quickly and it gets more and more complex. And, you know, the thing that makes me learn that stuff is composing a piece of music. And as soon as you compose a piece of music, you find all the learning falls into place as you reach out to people to help you figure out what you got to do.
But interesting then, if you bring somebody who's maybe a generation different, older or younger, who's so immersed in the technology, but they're not aware of some of the triggers and the patterns. That
I was
really
speaking
excite.
To Paul the other day. I couldn't turn my phone onto 4G for some reason. Paul's son Ben walks into the room, takes my phone. He's 10, right? Takes my phone from me, goes online, clicks it and gives it back and goes, there, Garrick, that's it.
Job done.
Job done.
So actually, that leads on very nicely to a point around learning and the multi-generational workforce with people working longer and longer. What are the implications from that point of view? How can the two
come
together?
Well, our perspective is well known. I mean, we write about this. We really think there's nothing more valuable than having wisdom and experience connected to youth and enthusiasm and everything in between. And there's nothing better than the digital platform, which allows for asynchronous working, asynchronous learning, and also connecting people to expertise rather than age, which really helps short circuit some of the difficulties we have in the physical world.
Well, I think it really that's part of solving the problem about how you keep people in work for a longer life, which is what we're hopefully looking at. And what we're seeing is the ability to plug in people and their expertise, which you can do digitally in an hour, in 2 hours, in a day, in a week, as and when needed, very readily, right? And we're working with groups of people from all over the world as a cohort of coaches and trainers, and they're able to plug in their skills as and when required. They are, if they want to work early in the morning because they want to do something in their community in the afternoon, great. They might be based in Europe, they might be coaching in Asia, and in the afternoon they might be playing golf.
Mm-hmm. And this
there's
this
a model,
and this is how you can transfer the wisdom, I suppose, because digital, it's not just a self-isolated e-learning, but actually you're interacting with people, you're using things like video to cross boundaries. You talked about that earlier, David. So that, do you see that as the big opportunity then to connect with the wisdom and learn?
But I also think there's a need to have a platform in which digital allows us to do this, where people can actually say, I need this kind of information now. A little bit like some of the stuff you see on Facebook where people go, has anybody got, you know, a part for a VW Beetle 1968? It's a little bit like that. I need to know about the strategy relating to X. Put that out there, and if you've got enough of a community, people can step up, go, I can help you with that. So it's kind of the push and the pull is required. Digital lets us do that much more easily than any other thing. I have a friend in the Netherlands, she runs very, very big, enormous events, you know, 10,000 people, and people mill around. But they do it all through badges, and you sign up online for the kinds of information you want. And anytime you come near to somebody who has a skill in that area, your badge flashes, and then you it's a bit like speed dating. But they're doing it on a huge scale through the technology.
And I think that's one of the interesting things, actually. We've started to see people create software which starts to recognize and say, this question is out there, these would be good people who should be answering that question and nudging those individuals to participate.
Yes.
And I think that whole sense of nudge is something that I think we'll see come more and more, and I'd expect that to sort of come out of the technology as well, sort of nudge us to be the best people we can be, which may be a bit like having another angel sat on your shoulder. It may be very irritating after a period of time. We all have our weaknesses. Mine's a packet of crisps. But being nudged, I think that there's a great opportunity. And I know Laszlo Bock is using that as part of his Humu project and the things he's starting to do with organizations. Think about how do I nudge the culture that the organization aspires to have.
So given everything we've heard today, and just to bring it together, some of the key points you talked about, creating a community that supports learning, tapping into the enthusiasm of the learner, a focus on adaptability, speed of learning, and providing that culture. What are some practical things that organizations can do today or start doing today to bring this into effect?
Yeah, I think I'd like to answer that almost from the individual's perspective of, I think if you want to be active, proactive, engaged, continuous learner, find the people that you respect and start to learn with them. I think there is something that we have our own responsibility to seek out the good brains, the good conversations who we can have, which help extend us. And hopefully there's some reciprocation for those people that we connect to, but I think we need to find the people that actually we want to learn with. And I think that's something that we can encourage organizations to think about how they promote that. But there's so much to be learned from community, and I think there's so much to be learned from each other. And it's also a great motivator when you're committed to sharing. It's a bit like book club, right? People who are in book club read books, and people who probably aren't in book clubs, so to speak, and reading circles, less so. You can create your own dynamic, create your own reality around that. And I think we should take a personal responsibility for finding those people and making that active. Five people might change your life.
And Garrick, what's your view?
I think that organizations are aware that learning is strategic, and good learning within an organization is a strategic advantage, and that if large organizations want to continue to win, achieve their goals, and so on, which is a strategic imperative, they have to enable learning to happen fast and quickly and powerfully. And the reason and the way that you do that is by tapping into what people want for themselves, their own motivations. So if you can make that connection between what I want to achieve as an individual and what the organization is trying to achieve strategically, and you connect that using all the tools of the digital realm, whether that's multimedia, flexibility, community groups, peer support, coaching, online, and asynchronous learning, all of those tools are available to people. You can change your organization overnight.
Thank you. And Paul, what about you? What's your view?
David, as you said earlier, if all organizations essentially becoming software organizations, then the way that one differentiates is, yes, through the quality of their software solutions, but actually through the quality of their people. And so the challenge for the organization is actually to therefore make their people as good as they can be, which really means making learning an imperative. And so they need to find ways to deliver learning that's quality learning at speed and at scale.
Thank you so much. This has been a fantastic and insightful conversation. Thank you so much to Paul, Garrick, and our special guest, David. You've been listening to a Ludic podcast, Alive, Digital Humans and Their Organizations. Thank you for joining us. Remember to subscribe to the podcast, and we look forward to hearing your thoughts on this and joining us the next time.